She awakened because the sound of the wheels had changed. It was an irregular beat, with sudden screeches and short, sharp cracks, a sound like the broken laughter of hysteria, and the fitful jerking of the car to match it. She knew before she glanced at her watch that this was the track of the Kansas Western, and that the train had started on its long detour south from Kirby, Nebraska. The train was half empty. Few people had ventured across the continent on the first comet since the tunnel disaster. She had given a bedroom to the tramp, and then had remained alone with his story. She had wanted to think of it, of all the questions she intended to ask him tomorrow. But she had found her mind frozen and still, like a spectator staring at the story, unable to function, only to stare. She had felt as if she knew the meaning of that spectacle, knew it with no further questions, and had to escape it. To move, had been the words beating in her mind with peculiar urgency. To move, as if movement had become an end in itself, crucial, absolute, and doomed. Through a thin layer of sleep, the sound of the wheels had kept running a race with the growth of her tension. She had kept awakening, as in a causeless start of panic, finding herself upright in the darkness, thinking blankly, what was it? Then telling herself in reassurance, we're moving. We're still moving. The track of the Kansas Western was worse than she had expected, she thought, listening to the wheels. The train was now carrying her hundreds of miles away from Utah. She had felt a desperate desire to get off the train on the main line, abandon all the problems of Taggart Transcontinental, find an airplane and fly straight to Quentin Daniels. It had taken a cheerless effort of will to remain in her car. She lay in the darkness listening to the wheels, thinking that only Daniels and his motor still remained like a point of fire ahead pulling her forward. Of what use would the motor now be to her? She had no answer. Why did she feel so certain of the desperate need to hurry? She had no answer. To reach him in time was the only ultimatum left in her mind. She held on to it, asking no questions. Wordlessly, she knew the real answer. The motor was needed not to move trains, but to keep her moving. She could not hear the beat of the fourth Knox any longer and the jumbled screeching of metal. She could not hear the steps of the enemy she was racing, only the hopeless stampede of panic. I'll get there in time, she thought. I'll get there first. I'll save the motor. There's one motor he's not going to stop, she thought. He's not going to stop. He's not going to stop. He's not going to stop, she thought, awakening with a jolt, jerking her head off the pillow. The wheels had stopped. For a moment she remained still, trying to grasp the peculiar stillness around her. It felt like the impossible attempt to create a sensory image of non-existence. There were no attributes of reality to perceive, nothing but their absence. No sound, as if she were alone on the train. No motion, as if this were not a train, but a room in a building. No light, as if this were neither train nor room, but space without objects. No sign of violence or physical disaster, as if this were the state where disaster is no longer possible. In the moment when she grasped the nature of the stillness, her body sprang upright with a single curve of motion, immediate and violent, like a cry of rebellion. The loud screech of the window shade went like a knife cut through the silence, as she threw the shade upward. There was nothing outside but anonymous stretches of prairie. A strong wind was breaking the clouds, and a shaft of moonlight fell through, but it fell upon plains that seemed as dead as those from which it came. The sweep of her hand pressed the light switch and the bell to summon the porter. The electric light came on and brought her back to a rational world. She glanced at her watch. It was a few minutes past midnight. She looked out of the rear window. The track went off in a straight line, and at the prescribed distance, she saw the red lanterns left on the ground, placed conscientiously to protect the rear of the train. The sight seemed reassuring. She pressed the porter's bell once more. She waited. She went to the vestibule, unlocked the door, and leaned out to look down the line of the train. A few windows were lighted in the long, tapering band of steel, but she saw no figures, no sign of human activity. She slammed the door, came back, and started to dress, her movements suddenly calm and swift. No one came to answer her bell. When she hastened across to the next car, she felt no fear, no uncertainty, no despair. Nothing but the urgency of action. There was no porter in the cubbyhole of the next car, no porter in the car beyond. She hurried down the narrow passageways, meeting no one. But a few compartment doors were open. The passengers sat inside, dressed or half-dressed, silently as if waiting. They watched her rush by with oddly furtive glances, as if they knew what she was after, as if they had expected someone to come and to face what they had not faced. She went on running down the spinal cord of a dead train, noting the peculiar combination of lighted compartments, open doors, and empty passages. No one had ventured to step out. No one had wanted to ask the first question. She ran through the train's only coach, where some passengers slept in contorted poses of exhaustion, while others, awake and still, sat hunched, like animals waiting for a blow, making no move to avert it. In the vestibule of the coach, she stopped. She saw a man who had unlocked the door and was leaning out, looking inquiringly ahead through the darkness, ready to step off. He turned at the sound of her approach. She recognized his face. It was Owen Kellogg, the man who had rejected the future she had once offered him. "Kellogg," she gasped, the sound of laughter in her voice like a cry of relief at the sudden sight of a man in a desert. "Hello, Miss Taggart," he answered, with an astonished smile that held a touch of incredulous pleasure and of wistfulness. "I didn't know you were aboard." "Come on," she ordered, as if he were still an employee of the railroad. "I think we're on a frozen train." "We are," he said, and followed her with prompt, disciplined obedience. No explanations were necessary. It was as if, in unspoken understanding, they were answering a call to duty, and it seemed natural that of the hundreds aboard, it was the two of them who should be partners in danger. "Any idea how long we've been standing?" she asked, as they hurried on through the next car. "Nope," he said. "We were standing when I woke up." They went the length of the train, finding no porters, no waiters in the diner, no brakeman, no conductor. They glanced at each other once in a while, but kept silent. They knew the stories of abandoned trains, of the crews that vanished in sudden bursts of rebellion against serfdom. They got off at the end of the train, with no motion around them save the wind on their faces, and they climbed swiftly aboard the engine. The engine's headlight was on, stretching like an accusing arm into the void of the night. The engine's cab was empty. Her cry of desperate triumph broke out in answer to the shock of the sight. "Good for them. They're human beings." She stopped, aghast, as at the cry of a stranger. She noticed that Kellogg stood watching her curiously, with the faint hint of a smile. It was an old steam engine, the best that the railroad had been able to provide for the Comet. The fire was banked in the grates, the steam gauge was low, and in the great windshield before them, the headlight fell upon a band of ties that should have been running to meet them, but lay still instead, like a ladder's steps, counted, numbered, and ended. She reached for the log book and looked at the names of the train's last crew. The engineer had been Pat Logan. Her head dropped slowly, and she closed her eyes. She thought of the first run on a green-blue track that must have been in Pat Logan's mind, as it was now in hers, through the silent hours of his last run on any rail. "Miss Taggart," said Owen Kellogg softly. She jerked her head up. "Yes," she said. "Yes. Well." Her voice had no color, except the metallic tinge of decision. "We'll have to get to a phone and call for another crew." She glanced at her watch. "At the rate we were running, I think we must be about 80 miles from the Oklahoma state line. I believe Bradshaw is this road's nearest division point to call. We're somewhere within 30 miles of it."
"Are there any Taggart trains following us?"
"The next one is number 253, the Transcontinental Freight. But it won't get here till about 7 a.m. if it's running on time, which I doubt."
"Only one freight in 7 hours?"
He said it involuntarily, with a note of outraged loyalty to the great railroad he had once been proud to serve. Her mouth moved in the brief snap of a smile. "Our transcontinental traffic is not what it was in your day." He nodded slowly.
I don't suppose there are any Kansas Western trains coming tonight either. I can't remember offhand, but I think not.
He glanced at the poles by the side of the track.
I hope that the Kansas Western people have kept their phones in order.
You mean that the chances are they haven't, if we judge by the state of their track.
But we'll have to try it.
Yes. She turned to go, but stopped. She knew it was useless to comment, but the words came out involuntarily.
You know, she said, it's those lanterns our men put behind the train to protect us that's the hardest thing to take. They felt more concern for human lives than their country had shown for theirs.
His swift glance at her was like a shot of deliberate emphasis. Then he answered gravely,
Yes, Miss Taggart.
Climbing down the ladder on the side of the engine, they saw a cluster of passengers gathered by the track, and more figures emerging from the train to join them. By some special instinct of their own, the men who had sat waiting knew that someone had taken charge. Someone had assumed the responsibility, and it was now safe to show signs of life. They all looked at her with an air of inquiring expectation as she approached. The unnatural pallor of the moonlight seemed to dissolve the differences of their faces and to stress the quality they all had in common. A look of cautious appraisal, part fear, part plea, part impertinence held in abeyance.
Is there anyone here who wishes to be spokesman for the passengers? She asked.
They looked at one another. There was no answer.
Very well, she said. You don't have to speak. I'm Dagny Taggart, the operating vice president of this railroad, and...
There was a rustle of response from the group, half movement, half whisper, resembling relief.
And I'll do the speaking. We're on a train that has been abandoned by its crew. There was no physical accident. The engine is intact, but there is no one to run it. This is what the newspapers call a frozen train. You all know what it means. And you know the reasons. Perhaps you knew the reasons long before they were discovered by the men who deserted you tonight. The law forbade them to desert. But this will not help you now.
A woman shrieked suddenly with the demanding petulance of hysteria.
What are we going to do?
Dagny paused to look at her. The woman was pushing forward to squeeze herself into the group, to place some human bodies between herself and the sight of the great vacuum, the planes stretching off and dissolving into moonlight. The dead phosphorescence of impotent, borrowed energy. The woman had a coat thrown over a nightgown. The coat was slipping open, and her stomach protruded under the gown's thin cloth, with that loose obscenity of manner which assumes all human self-revelation to be ugliness and makes no effort to conceal it. For a moment, Dagny regretted the necessity to continue.